Please welcome to the stage Bob Prince, Chair and Co-CIO of Bridgewater Associates, in conversation with Ida Liu, CEO at HSBC Private Bank.
Hello. I'm absolutely thrilled to be with Bob Prince, the Chair of the Board and Co-CIO of Bridgewater. Bob, it's also a pleasure to have you as a longstanding private bank client, so even more exciting for me to be on the stage with you. Bob, you have just celebrated at Bridgewater your 50th year anniversary last year. So tell us, what's the secret to building longstanding, durable, and resilient portfolios for clients?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ida. It's really great to be here. You're right. You know, last year was a really big year for us. It was our 50th anniversary. And in addition to the anniversary, a lot of great things happened in terms of our transition and our governance and so on and so forth. And as we sit here today at age 50, we're almost like a startup, you know, going into the next 50 years. But, you know, when I think about what it takes to have that sort of long-term survivability or success, I do think that, you know, the first rule of investing is survive. It's really capital preservation, because if you conserve capital, if you survive, there will always be opportunities, but you have to be around to take advantage of them, right? And so, you know, you need a good offense, but I think you really start with a good defense in managing money. If I could take a minute and maybe describe a little bit about how we manage money and how we view the world, then it might help you see things through our eyes. I think there are really two elements to long-term survivability and performance in the markets. I think there's an organizational element, and I think there's an investment process element. For us, the organizational element really started with that the overarching goal is simply continuous improvement. And when you're an organization and your goal is continuous improvement, it actually then calls for a certain culture. It calls for a meritocracy of ideas, where the best ideas win, not seniority. It calls for a very clear and explicit recognition of what your weaknesses and your vulnerabilities are, because it's actually your weaknesses and your vulnerabilities that are the fuel for the improvement, right? And that has a parallel to the markets, because in the markets, you really have to, you know, the markets seem like they're always trying to find your weak spot, right? And they do, usually. But in the markets, you have to understand what your vulnerabilities are, what your weaknesses are, and you actually have to plan for them. So for us, the way that we do that is that our investment process is what we call fundamental and systematic, which is that by fundamental, I mean we try to think about the world economy and markets and think about that like a machine, that there are cause-effect linkages, levers and pulleys, and those cause-effect linkages describe how things play out over time. And so given that understanding of those cause-effect linkages in the markets, we then prescribe a game plan so that if this happens, we'll do that, and if this happens, we'll do that. And we can then write down that game plan, we can program it, and we can then stress test it through history, mostly to find out what your vulnerabilities and weaknesses are, right? How bad is it when you're wrong? And plan for being wrong so you can stay in the game. So I think those are two big elements of resilience and survivability in the markets. I think they're generally applicable, right? You need diversification, but then you need agility. And agility means you need a plan for if this happens, I'll do that. If this happens, I'll do that. And then you have to and test that plan and have the ability to then carry it out.
It's almost like doing a health check for our clients' portfolios on a regular basis, right? And I love what you said about the meritocracy. I love what you said about really risk managing on behalf of clients as well. So let's do a double click on that. How would you think about global asset allocation today for clients, and where are those opportunities?
You know, well, it's interesting. Most people don't start there. Most investment portfolios start with the market cap index. And because the U.S. markets have done so well in the last 15 years, and because the dollar has done so well, a market cap index is massively overweight the U.S. right now, right? And so you're starting off with a yeah, I think it's the U.S. market cap is 70% of the world market cap, which means it needs to attract 70 cents out of every dollar into equities to stay where it is. So that's a bad starting point, because you're starting with a concentrated portfolio that's vulnerable to just a couple of things, right? It's much more, our approach is much more, it's starting with a portfolio that is diversified across countries, it's diversified across assets, it's diversified across conditions, and it's diversified across strategies. Because all of those things are important contributors to an outcome, but all four of those can have their own what we call environmental biases, meaning any asset, any strategy, any country will have its inherent environmental biases, meaning an exogenous influence that will drive your outcome. And so the first thing that we try to do in building a portfolio is to build a portfolio that minimizes environmental biases. And then when we work with our clients, try to help work with our clients, which are to help them, you know, do the same.
Bob, I know you'll agree with me that there's only two points that matter. It's when you get in and when you get out. And there's a lot of volatility that happens in between. But as a, you know, as an investment advisor, really thinking about building those durable portfolios, as you suggested, that will withstand the challenges over time and over the decades.
Yeah.
But you know, it almost seems today like risk and volatility is the new normal for investors with all of the challenges that we're seeing around the world. You know, where are you positioning and where do you see those opportunities despite the geopolitical concerns around the world?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, there are these sort of timeless things that are always at risk, and then there are these time-specific things. And if I go to the timeless things, you know, the economic cycle always matters, right? Economic growth and inflation, they always matter. They drive monetary policy, which drives interest rates and drives asset prices. And so globally, as a timeless approach, we're always trying to start off with a balance to economic growth and inflation, to not be tilted one way or the other. And if you start in a balanced position, you can then also always take risk one way or the other, given what you see at the time. So I think that's a key fundamental driver, starting with a balance to growth and inflation. And then you have the time-specific risks, which are particularly, you know, high and varied today. But I'll describe kind of the two big ones, we think. One is what we call modern mercantilism, which is sort of how the economic machine is now working, which is very different than it's worked in the past, which is the idea of modern mercantilism where governments are very directly involved in enhancing the wealth and power of their economy, and accumulation of assets is a good thing, trade balances are a bad thing, and you know, to some extent, you know, China has implemented that sort of policy for a long time, active involvement of the government in the economy, to great success. And in the last few years, and with Donald Trump in particular, now the US is going heavy into that approach. And what happens when the US is there and China has been there, it requires a comparable response from somebody else. Like if you're operating from your own self-interest heavily, then somebody else has to protect their position, somebody else to protect. So this modern mercantilism is spreading globally. It has all kinds of manifestations, fiscal stimulation, military spending, and so on and so forth. The second big driver, though, is AI. And I would say in the near term, AI is in the middle of a very big inflection point. It's gone from an idea and a possibility to a reality. It's starting to impact actual businesses and how they operate, starting to impact jobs, we saw it in the software stocks, but there are really three big risks related to AI right now. One is that in the very near term, you're going to have a pretty massive supply-demand imbalance for compute and basically everything along the supply chain, which is creating a what we call a resource grab, where everybody has got to get the resources that they need now so that down the line they don't have a bottleneck. So that's number one, big supply-demand imbalance. The second thing is company-wide, company and sector disruptions as a very big influence. And then the third one I think is less well-recognized, which is I think we're on the verge of a political backlash against AI. In the sense that when you look at the spending that's occurring today, GDP growth is strong, but it's very unbalanced. It's much more, spending on capital expenditures for technology, much less on household incomes, much less on consumer spending. You're getting already an income disparity that's opening up again. And even if AI is successful in generating the levels of productivity that support the investment that's been made, the secondary effects of that are going to be income distribution issues. And when you get income distribution issues, that was the basis of populism in the United States. It was the basis of Donald Trump coming to power. And so I think we're looking at a next wave of income distribution issues related to AI. And you're starting to hear kind of the straws in the wind right now, kind of the Bernie Sanders of the world. But by the time we get to the midterms, you're going to hear more. And by the time we get to the next presidential election, you're going to hear more. And it also goes to data centers and electricity prices and, potentially lost jobs and so forth. So I think that's the thing to be looking out for. These are the things to be looking out for with respect to the next kind of the next set of wave related to AI. But it will be successful as a tool, but as a result of the success, it brings along these other issues.
No, indeed, Bob. And in addition to the tremendous growth in AI, there's so many different opportunities peripheral and around AI as well. As AI is growing, there's also a growing need for energy and supply of electricity and energy
exactly.
to supply the growth in AI. So looking at clean energy sources and the brains behind AI, the semiconductor industry, and so on. So a lot at stake and a lot at play here around AI too. And I loved how you talked about the core portfolio and the tactical elements around the core, which is really a healthy way to think about investor portfolios. Are there other tactical elements that you're seeing at the moment?
Yeah, sure. The really interesting thing about the global environment in the last few years is how radically different the conditions in Asia have been from the West. Because it goes back to COVID. Because coming out of COVID, the policy response in the US and Europe and other countries in the West was print, fiscal stimulation, and that was overdone, which produced a big inflationary cycle. And in Asia, it was much more social controls. And so coming out of COVID, you had inflation in the West and deflation and weak economies in the East, and then you also had a political backlash and the withdrawal of US capital from China. And that whole combination actually sort of drove risk premiums up in Asia. But because there was no inflation problem, that policymakers had the latitude to support economies with liquidity. Now, in China's case, they didn't do it aggressively, but they did it moderately. But generally, the financial system was in a position, and policymakers and monetary policy was accommodative. So whenever you have high risk premiums, low inflation, and accommodative policies, you have the ingredients for good asset performance. And in the last few years, the Asian markets, if I consider kind of across asset stocks and bonds and across assets, have been by far the best performing markets. And that continues to this day. We still have a tilt toward Asia. It's not nearly like it was because during the other side of that cycle, 180 degrees on the other side of that cycle, was an overheating economy and inflation and tight money. in the U.S. and Europe and the West, so which was bad for assets. So you had the worst conditions for in the West, you had the best conditions in the East, and really favored a shift in that direction. And that ultimately panned out in asset returns. But that sort of equilibrated to this point. And actually, you know, one of the things that we always look at is, what is the aggregate level of economic conditions cyclically across countries, and does it allow for a central bank to maintain accommodative policies? And actually, in like 80% of the world today, that is true. Coming out of 2019, 2021, it was only true in about maybe 10% of the world. But that's also supported asset returns in the last year or so. So globally, we're pretty diversified because of that. Pretty balanced between asset classes, although moderately favoring stocks in relation to bonds, because this whole CapEx cycle is really good for profits, and the fiscal borrowing and the demand for capital is not so good for interest rates. But you're not on the verge of a major tightening of monetary policies. It's pretty much steady as she goes. But on the margin, you know, conditions in Asia are still, you know, moderately favorable, we think, relative to the rest of the world. So we're a bit over positioned there.
So let's double click on the tilt towards Asia and the favorable environment here in Asia. Obviously, we're sitting in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. Which is one of the wealth hubs of the world. So where do you see the opportunities here in this region?
Well, obviously, there's a huge tech thing going on, right? Well, all the IPOs in Hong Kong in the last year is big. You know, when I say we're kind of overweight Asia, we start off with what's called a balanced portfolio, where we kind of leverage the bonds up and deleverage the equities and balance. Risk parity is a term for it, but we balance the risks across assets so we're not overexposed to stocks or bonds or commodities. That's our starting point. As I said, that's kind of the defense, right? And so for the most part, we're holding pretty balanced portfolios across assets on a risk basis, and then also across economies in Asia with a bit of a tilt. You know, it's a bit better for equities because rates have come down so much.
So, Bob, in our last few minutes together, are there any other key takeaways that you want to share with the investors in the room?
Well, it starts with a good defense, right? Managing money starts with diversification. It starts with agility. Diversification, agility, and resilience are kind of the three things that I think about. And when we work with our institutional clients, this is the focus. So, but even when you think about diversification, how do you get diversification? Correlations are very unstable. We don't use correlations. The correlation between stocks and bonds ranges between 0.7 and minus 0.7. Like there's so how do you get diversification is a base, and the way we approach it is you have to get diversification aligned with the fundamental conditions and the drivers of markets, right? So diversification is your starting point, but then agility is really important because diversification deals with the things that you cannot possibly predict but might happen, like things that have been the last few months, right? Agility is then, as conditions unfold, now what are you going to do about that? And so agility requires sort of thinking in advance about what types of outcomes, what kind of conditions are going to trigger you to take what kind of action, and having a game plan to then execute that game plan as those conditions unfold. And then resiliency is where it all comes together, because resiliency is really around achieving higher and more consistent long-term returns. And that's really achieved by diversification and agility brought together into an ongoing process and a plan, which goes ultimately to the way you run your organization and the culture around that.
Diversification, agility, and resilience. Incredible. Thank you so much, Bob, for the extraordinary takeaways from the discussion today. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Prince.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.